Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. This week, my co-host is Martin. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. Pretty good. Not too bad. We also have a guest this week, which is great. And we've got Mark Carlson here. Now, Mark is the co-chair of the SNEA Technical Council. Is that correct, Mark?
Yes, that's correct.
Excellent. So give us a bit of background about yourself and what you do, and that'll help us, I guess, explain what our conversation is for this week.
Sure, yeah. I work on the sort of supplier side now. I used to work for Sun Microsystems and Oracle, more on the consumer side of storage, although they did resell quite a few systems as well. The reason I switched sides is because I saw that enterprise storage was not going to be growing as fast as it had in the past. And on the supplier side of things, we'll sell to the hyperscalers, we'll sell to enterprise storage, whoever will buy the drives, but we learn a lot of interesting things from having a more diverse set of customers like that.
The reason you're here, obviously, is part of SNEA, and you've talked a little bit about the drive side of things, but the conversation we're having today is talking about exactly how hyperscalers are taking traditional storage media, hard drives and SSDs, hopefully, and how they're using it in their environment. And we're going to talk through how they do things differently and what they might be doing. So let's just start off with level setting it for everybody. What are we talking about when we say hyperscalers? I mean, what would you define as the hyperscalers in this market?
Well, there's different classifications, of course, but what we're really talking about is the tier one data center building internet-based companies such as Amazon, Google, Microsoft Azure, Facebook in the US, and there's another three in China that are often called hyperscalers, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. And so these seven companies are sort of the tier one folks that are building data centers at huge scales across the planet and are, as a result, purchasing components more or less directly from the component manufacturers. And this is different from enterprises that have typically bought systems from system suppliers in the past.
So when we say they're buying direct, they're obviously buying significantly larger amounts of capacity and storage than even enterprises would buy potentially.
Yes. Well, you know, building five data centers a year tends to up your buying power with the actual component vendors in that they will listen to you when you say build them this way.
So yes, Mark, I mean, I know that, for instance, the latest IDC figure showed a huge increase in what we call OEM sales, that side of the market. So I guess they must be buying petabytes worth of capacity every year, if not more.
Yeah, they actually have a new category rather than OEM. They're talking about ODMs, D with a dog, original design manufacturers, I think it is. And these are the guys that will take a system design, such as ones from the Open Compute Project, and they'll build them for the hyperscalers and populate them with components. And what shows up at the data center is racks and racks and racks of drives. And there may be some compute. Up to 50% of the rack might be actual compute, and 50% might be drives. And that ratio probably changes based on whether you're hard drives or solid state drives in those racks.
Got you. So it's not necessarily Amazon ringing up and saying, ship me 300 boxes of disk, and they get them turning up as drives they have to do something with. These things are being put together by the ODMs and then shipped to the hyperscalers.
That's right. There's a qualification process usually before they specify your disks. Right. So you ship them a bunch of drives. They put them in racks themselves to do their testing. And then 6 months later, hopefully you find out that, verily, you're now on the supplier list for them. But what you end up doing is shipping them to the ODM, who assembles them into racks, make sure everything's working, and then that gets shipped to the actual data center.
So, Mark, so haven't some of the traditional hardware vendors, such as the Dells and HPE, tried to get in on this and actually try to run their own lines for larger corporates or even people who are not quite hyperscale?
Sure, yeah. There is a tier two of folks that are still building data centers, but they're not building five a year. Yeah. Maybe they build one or two a year. And certainly the folks in the financial industry, for example, are still building data centers, and largely because they have so many government regulations that they have to comply with. There isn't a cloud vendor out there that can handle all the regulations and compliance and paperwork and whatnot. So those folks are hoping to leverage the same techniques as the hyperscalers by going through ODMs and so forth. And yes, Dell is also an ODM. So they will, if you just want racks and racks of stuff without any of their special sauce, they'll sell it to you. HP had a deal with Foxconn. I'm not sure how valid that deal is anymore. But yes, they've tried to become ODMs. It's a very low margin business. And, you know, they'd like to upsell you to their actual systems that they've designed rather than the off-the-shelf OCP hardware.
Yeah, I think some of the telcos as well are trying to go down the ODM route for some of their stuff because they tend to work at such a large scale these days.
Yeah, and telcos are still building data centers.
Why are the requirements of these guys different then? I mean, what are they looking to achieve? Is this about, I mean, we clearly know it's custom build and it's buying more commodity style of things, but what else from a component side of things, from like the media, are they doing differently?
Yeah, they're hot buttons, high order bit, one of which is read latencies. If you have read latencies and you occasionally get a tail latency that's 10 to 20 times longer than your normal latency, that causes all sorts of problems because of the way they've designed their applications and infrastructure code on top of these devices. That one tail latency will impact a whole thread of drive accesses and slow it down to that slowest response. So the entire page takes longer to load. The entire financial transaction takes longer to happen. And that causes all sorts of problems with their quality of service to their users. The other very important concern of theirs is write amplification, wearing out the drives because of how they're using the drives. And if they can get some help on that end of things through new features in the drives, that will help things as well. So those are the two, I would say, most important things that they want to see different coming out of these drives is being able to tackle the tail latency issue and be able to tackle the write amplification issue.
Okay, so before we go back and talk about that from a technical perspective, what about differences in the way that they want to use this equipment? Because I would have thought because they're designing much more lightweight racked equipment, they probably don't want the same sort of dual-ported drives. They probably have a very big focus on TCO of their platforms and their components compared to perhaps the way a traditional or an enterprise vendor might look at it.
Yeah, traditionally in the enterprise vendor market, they design their systems such that there's no single point of failure. So you have redundant power supplies, you have redundant paths, you have dual ported, like you said. However, in the hyperscaler way, they basically design them for scale out and physical redundancy of nodes. So if a node fails, the software just automatically routes around it, creates another copy of the data from previous copies they already stored, and everything stays up and running even though a whole node went down. The philosophy on the enterprise side is to keep that node up, you know, even in the face of failing components within it. Whereas in hyperscalers, as soon as something starts to go flaky at all, they just shut the node down, diagnose it later, replace parts on a very slow schedule, not immediately going out into the data center to replace something to get it up and working again. It's really more of a, well, it's reached its end of life. We'll replace it next time we come through the data center.
Okay, so Martin, I mean, looking at it from, say, your position and my position about where we've come from, I think we got used to the idea that somebody might go in periodically once a week to swap disks out because shared storage could get away with that with spares. It sounds like this is like, you know, that on steroids almost.
Well, yeah, I mean, so certainly where we're talking about bulk storage, yeah, we've got to a stage where we will get engineer in once a week in theory just to swap the disks out. It sounds like, but this is at a whole new level. This is at server level. So even if a server falls down, power it off, the cloud or whatever routes around it, and rip it out, fix it, bench it if you want, or trash it, I suppose.
Yeah, strip the bits out that you could use and move on.
Yeah, so with disk drives, they're just as likely, if it starts flaking out, rather than go to extraordinary efforts to recover the data, they got the data elsewhere anyway. They're just going to mark it bad and mark it for service and swap it out with something, send it back to the drive manufacturer. They don't care why. All they know is it was flaking out in their environment, send it back.
Let's touch on some of the details of that technical side, because I do have a question related to that that I think might be quite relevant. And that's, let's talk about the idea of that failure mode, and then we'll come back to tail latency in a second. But I would have thought if you've got a server with a lot of disk in and drives that are getting to the now multi-terabyte size, that you would want to try and minimize as much as possible rebuilds if you could. And therefore, if a drive fails, rather than failing the entire drive because of one part of the drive has failed, you would want to try and somehow manage that recovery process a bit better. Maybe you just treat the failure as a temporary thing and move on very quickly, or maybe you just use the drive partially. Is that something they're looking at, or is that just too simplistic a model?
Well, there's sort of a repurposing that we put into some of the standards like SCSI and SATA. It's called DPOP, where basically you reset the drive to more or less factory state, but it may have less space than it had before, either because SSD wanted to reclaim some over-provisioning space so that the drive can last longer, or maybe a track or a head went bad on a hard drive, but the rest of the drive is fine. And so the idea there is that you basically come up with a smaller amount of storage, but that smaller amount of storage can then be put back into service without servicing the drive itself. So that's DPOP. And the way their software-defined storage layer works, similar to Ceph or SwiftStack or others, basically they'll repopulate that drive with, you know, third copies of the data that they already have elsewhere, or they'll put more shards on that drive now that are used to restore the redundancy back up to three copies of the data, for example. So they're not really rebuilding the drive with its previous state. They're putting objects on, or shards of objects that may or may not have been on there before.
Yeah, got you. So they're just reusing the space effectively, yeah, but for something else, yeah, at that point. Yeah. Let's go back to tail latency, because we sort of talked about that and then we stepped away from it. So tail latency, we're saying that in that instance, the drive, and you can tell me in a second whether it's HDD as well as SSD, but the drive itself gives you, for whatever reason, an elongated response time, and that massively affects the application. So the vendors want to get around that somehow.
Right. There's sort of two approaches. One is kind of a noisy neighbor issue, where because the SSDs are getting bigger and bigger, then more and more applications need to be running against that individual drive. And when you have multiple applications that aren't coordinated like that, one application can interfere with the other applications and cause these tail latencies. They'd like to have some way to isolate a large drive into smaller non-interfering spaces. And in NVMe, we came up with something called NVM sets. And these NVM sets, then perhaps on the back end, they don't share a channel. They don't share dies or channels. And so when an application is in there doing something, it won't affect the other NVM sets that are on separate channels and separate dies.
Okay, but that was only possible, I guess, because NVMe has many multiple channels, and SATA and SAS, the way it's defined today, would, I guess, have difficulty implementing that technique.
Yeah, it's not anticipated that this would go to something like SAS, but it could, especially since SAS is being used more and more for SSDs. But they mainly pushed it into NVMe because they saw themselves using NVMe drives going forward. All four hyperscalers, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Azure, came to NVMe and said, solve this problem for us.
Okay. What about the tail latency on hard drives? Is that fixable, or are there techniques for that?
There are, and that work is going on an ad hoc to SATA and SAS development groups. So Google and Facebook are in there creating something called a fast fail for hard drive reads. And if it looks like that hard drive is going to throw a tail latency because it has to, you know, wait for the platter to come around to the same location and do a second read, there's an option for it to just say, sorry, it's going to take a while. Maybe you can get this data from someplace else faster than it will take me to recover the data. Right? Maybe there's a block going bad or something. So that can throw a tail latency out of a hard drive. Fast fail will allow you to use another copy from someplace else, perhaps more quickly.
So tail latency isn't anything new, certainly in hard drives, is it? Because array manufacturers have struggled with tail latency as well, where it's caused all kinds of problems.
Yeah, because of the software architecture above the drives, in these hyperscaler situations, the tail latencies exacerbate the problems they're already experiencing.
Yeah, the application design gets in the way there, so I guess...
Yeah, it's more costly to re-architect your applications to not care about tail latencies than it is just to tell the drive manufacturers to do something different.
Yeah, got you. Okay, so let's talk about other things then that the manufacturer is looking for.
Yeah. So the other thing that was causing these tail latencies was the drive itself. And the drive itself has to do some maintenance operations, right? It has to do some garbage collection in order to free up erase blocks. It has to do what we call read patrol, where you're actually going through and making sure the data is still okay, kind of like a scrub. And then there's the, you know, there's error correction within the drive itself that can cause tail latencies. So we wanted to be able to control these tasks. So that when the application was doing this latency-sensitive reads, he could hold off some of the things that would interfere with that latency from the drive itself. So there's kind of a windowing API that lets us put the drive into what we call a deterministic window, where background tasks are held off. And the drive will tell the application that, hey, this maintenance is building up. You better let me do some maintenance pretty soon. And so then he'll put him in a non-deterministic window where he can do writes, where he can do garbage collection, where he can do all the things that would impact a read latency.
Which is quite neat, I suppose, because it means, as you said, it's the deterministic part that you're looking to gain. And as long as those functions right. are turned off, you should expect a deterministic, i.e. consistent, repeatable I/O latency. So that gives a lot more for the application to track, and I guess that's probably fine in their instances because they've got lots of people who can write the code that will actually go away and do that background management task because I guess they've got lots of developers.
Yeah. The other approach besides using these new features in NVMe, some hyperscalers want to do this open channel approach where those background tasks would be done by the host on the host schedule when the host deems them necessary, and that way you control those background tasks and prevent the tail latencies as well.
From what you're telling us, Mark, lots of different things that people want to do. Which ones are being pushed into standards and who's driving that and how is that being driven?
Well, the NVMe pieces are done. They're external. They're sort of external to the specification in its current state. The way NVMe does things is it has a version of the specification, then it applies two different type of changes. One is an error correction. They found a bug in the current spec, and they do an ECN, engineering change notification, to update the spec to fix that bug. You can't introduce any new technical changes with that method. The other method is a technical proposal, and the technical proposal is used to introduce new features that aren't in the current spec. And so in combination with the latest solid spec and any ECNs applied to it, you can then implement this technical proposal. And so these have been standardized as technical proposals, so people are off actually implementing these new features.
How long do they normally take to come in then once somebody's decided that there's a new feature that you're going to add, you know, in terms of deciding to do it, implementing it and rolling out and actually being in either end products or end devices?
Yeah, so mainly it's a matter of how severe are the architectural changes to implement a new feature. If I can just change the drive's firmware to do something slightly different, I can get that out fairly quickly in a firmware update. But if you're talking about something like the I/O determinism work I just talked about, in order to do that efficiently and so forth, you may need a new system on a chip hardware controller that takes taping out and spinning, you know, whatever. Silicon schedules are years in the making, right? And so while you may see something that can do with a firmware change to get something out there, to really see an efficient, scalable, performance-wise, you may be looking at a year or more.
Martin, from your perspective, if you knew those sort of big changes were coming down the line, I don't know how many nowadays vendors would expose to you as a customer, but would you be concerned about big changes like that to protocols, or would you just put it through normal testing and just not care?
I would just put it through normal testing and don't really care. Generally, these things are at such a low level, so when they get to us, we're not especially interested, or we're interested, but we don't especially care. We're not as sophisticated as the hyperscalers, so we're going to assume that the vendors we're dealing with can take advantage of the right changes and the right standards without us actually having to worry about what it means at a deep technical level.
What about changes at the operating system level and other things as well? Now, just going back to that, Mark, obviously you said that the hyperscalers are doing a lot of stuff at the next level up. I imagine they still have to have things like operating systems. They're still probably running on standard versions of, say, the Linux kernel. So there must be changes that they're making or have to make there to get some of this stuff to work, I would have thought.
Exactly, yes. And so for the IO determinism work in NVMe, you want something that controls this windowing or schedules these windows, and that has to be integrated with their software-defined storage as well, so that the software-defined storage knows that, hey, I got to keep one of these three drives in this deterministic window. The other two drives, they could be off doing some background maintenance, right? Or I could be writing the next object to those. And so you know, if you have multiple drives that you're coordinating multiple copy things, you have to coordinate this windowing, and that needs to be done at a fairly low level.
Okay, so significant changes then that they're making all the time, I guess.
Yeah, they have infrastructure software that could get updates propagated worldwide several times per day. Right, so if they see something they need a fix for, they can rapidly get it out there into all their systems. So, you know, they don't work on sort of a release schedule for their software. They work on a push. Where are we going to push this to production, right? And so they may do that several times a day. They may roll it out in a small area, make sure it's working, and then roll it out in a larger area. You know, they have these DevOps folks. They call them SREs, site reliability engineers, but they're not only making sure everything stays up and running, but they're pushing out new stuff all the time, either to fix existing problems, improve performance, improve scalability, improve their own monitoring capabilities. It's all pretty much rapid, just-in-time development of the whole infrastructure. And then they have various apps that run on top of that that are done by other groups.
Right.
Their job is to keep that infrastructure and all the infrastructure code up and running, including drive firmware.
Okay, so let's think about what happens when those changes are made. And clearly, the hyperscalers are having significant impact nowadays in talking to the media suppliers. Do we think that we're likely to see a divergence in the media and have enterprise class and hyperscaler class media? Or do you think actually what will happen is the hyperscalers' requirements will just filter down into enterprise products that we deploy in our normal stuff in the data center?
Well, the design of enterprise storage is still focused on no single point of failure. And that has implications on the type of drives that they're buying from the suppliers. And so the suppliers, the drive suppliers, still have to have separate sort of enterprise devices and hyperscaler devices because they are different. There are different requirements on them. The hyperscalers want cheap. So they don't want dual ports, right? Cheap may mean that there's not as much power loss protection on the drives. Maybe the host is willing to do something to tell the drive, give the drive some time to save off any volatile data into non-volatile media without having to have a bunch of supercaps on board. So cost per gigabyte, you know, probably the number one factor in why they want multiple suppliers supplying them at different price points. The hard thing has been to get, you know, the hyperscalers to get together and tell us the same thing. You know, in the US, we don't want four different customers with four different set of requirements so we can sell the hyperscalers, right? We don't want seven different sets of requirements to sell to them worldwide. We want them to get together and give, you know, standardize things like they have been starting to do now so that we can create one device that at least satisfies all the hyperscaler requirements without, you know, individually tweaking it for Amazon or Google.
But there must have been advancements that have actually translated into enterprise. And if I pick as an example, I would have thought form factor perhaps would have been something that was driven by the hyperscalers, but actually could be an enterprise feature that you could use. So for instance, the M.2 or at least the new NF1 format that Samsung are using, some of the stuff that's coming out like Ruler. I wonder whether that could be perfectly happily used in the enterprise and whether that was driven by the hyperscalers or not, or whether that's just the way the industry's gone.
Yeah, so there's a reason they like to use these small M2 drives, and that's because of the noisy neighbor problem, right? If they can implement sort of their own physical NVMe sets by putting two or four of these M2 drives on a single carrier card, right? Then at least for those four drives, they can have four different apps hitting that one carrier card. Until implementations of the I/O determinism allow you to have a bigger device and treat it like four small devices or eight small devices, right? Then and only then would they probably move away from the M2 form factor. And then they're looking at, so how many NVMe sets can you give me on this one 40 terabyte SSD? They'd like to have something around 40 or 80 NVMe sets, because the working set of their apps tends to be anywhere from a half to 1 terabyte. Well, they're telling us they want half to 1 terabyte NVMe sets out of however big a drive you can give me. But, you know, if your NVMe sets are 2 or 4 or 8 terabytes, forget it. That's too big.
So I think we may use some of these features in the enterprise as we move to a more containerized environment. So to the ability to have microservices, lots of them on a single host. So some of these features may allow us to performance manage the containers in a much better way than we've got at the moment. So I can see it actually appearing in enterprise. It may need some engineering work from the vendors, or we just move much more closer to what we think a hyperscale infrastructure looks like with local storage on hosts, on servers, and move away from the array for some of these applications.
Yeah, I can see that. Making complete sense. You know, I think that's one of the interesting things for me, Mark, is that idea that you can take a drive and divide it up logically and then talk to each individual section, because then you can, as you said, eliminate things like noisy neighbor and all those other characteristics that go with it. So I think for me, that's probably one of the most interesting, one of the features that they're talking about. But in general, so some really interesting developments that's been driven from that side of the market. So that was great, Mark. Where can people follow up on this to find out about some of the technology we talked about, to maybe, you know, watch stuff online or to read stuff? You know, where do you want to point people at to go and look at this sort of stuff?
Sure. We've done a couple of white papers as the SNIA. One is on different standards that already exist. The Technical Council did a white paper on some of the standards that will address this, such as FastFail and Open Channel as well. And then we also did an interview with financial company that is following the hyperscaler practices to build out their own data center and things like software-defined storage, best-in-class drives and systems. I've also done several BrightTalk webcasts as well as the Tech Field Day video, and that's all up on SNIA's YouTube channel. If you just go to YouTube and search for SNIA, you'll find the YouTube channel there. Done talks at the Storage Developer Conference as well. Those slides and videos are available as well.
What about if people want to follow you? Where can we find you online to stalk?
Yeah, I'm at MacSun, MacSun, for historical reasons. And you can follow me on Twitter. My feed points you to all the content.
Okay, that's great. Thanks for joining us, Mark. That was really interesting. If anybody wants to check us out online, as usual, you can get us at storageunpacked.com, at storageunpacked on Twitter. And you can search for our LinkedIn group and find us there, where we'll post this podcast link and the material that Mark talked about earlier. Thanks for joining us, Mark, and thanks, Martin.
Thanks, Greg.
Cheers, Chris.